Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. The direct threats caused by changing weather patterns, such as more intense and frequent storms and heat waves, well, they're pretty easy to spot in central and northern Wisconsin. But the indirect threats of climate change, including increased rates of Lyme disease and other insect-borne pathogens, and the effects of larger and longer algal blooms, are becoming more and more obvious to scientists. Still, they might surprise you. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. For our first segment of this week's program, we welcome Dr. Andreas Kogelnik of the Open Medicine Institute and Howard Young Foundation Director Aaron Biertzer, both key players in Woodruff's Tick-Borne Illness Center. They're going to be discussing the connection between central and northern Wisconsin's rising temperatures and the increasing prevalence of tick-borne illnesses and diseases in the area. Later in the program, we'll discuss rising water levels and the potential consequences for human health in the area. And finally, in our third segment, we'll be joined by a Wisconsin DNR research scientist to discuss the effects of larger and longer-lasting algal blooms in our local waterways. We'll take your calls and questions, too. Join the conversation by calling in at 800-780-9742. Dr. Kogelnik and Aaron, welcome to Route 51. So pleased to have you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Well, let's start by explaining a little bit about Woodruff's new tick center. What is it, and where is it, and why is it located in northern Wisconsin?
Well, as the director of the new center, I can say I was extremely pleased when we were approached about a year ago by the Howard Young Foundation, and Aaron's the director, with the idea even of placing a center up here, and I think Aaron can speak to the reasons why that happened, but the bottom line is that there's a huge epidemic of tick-borne illnesses, and northern Wisconsin, and actually the whole state of Wisconsin for that matter, is in one of the hot zones for these kinds of cases. And so it seemed like an appropriate place to put a center like that with a huge need on the clinical side, but also there's a lot that's unknown about these diseases, and we wanted to start addressing that from a science and data perspective.
So construction is underway. When will it actually open?
Well, we're actually done with construction as of yesterday.
So
we're just waiting for some approvals and regulatory certifications, and then we're hoping to be open relatively soon. We're hiring staff and physicians, and we're very excited, hoping to be open shortly.
Okay. So what will the focus be? Is this diagnosis and treatment, studying the tick population? What does this all encompass?
Well, first and foremost, I think we are trying to serve a need of patients. And, we already have actually quite a long waiting list, so that to me speaks to the need. There's just a huge need for people to be cared for who have these illnesses, to be properly diagnosed and properly treated. And there's a lot of misunderstanding both in the community as well as in the physician community around these diseases, and a lot we have to learn still. And so part of this is a care mission, part of this is an education mission, and part of it is a research mission to gather more information and expand our knowledge around the various diseases that ticks can carry.
Okay. I'm taking a look at the CDC chart that shows the health impacts of climate change. And, of course, they have a bunch of different areas in which climate change has an impact on human health. But one thing that really caught my eye was the change in vector ecology, the change in malaria, West Nile virus. And I see that Lyme disease is in that category. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I mean, as you said, as you change the ecology of the world around us, the bugs, both the insect bugs as well as the bacteria and so forth, change how they live and how they reproduce around us. And with sort of the warming trends that have been going on, the tick populations, particularly in the northern climates where they were previously not as robust, or at least had a winter dead season, so to speak, those have shortened. And that increases both the physical area as well as the temporal time when those ticks can survive. And so there's a lot more of them out there. And there's also been lots of changes, of course, in the deer and moose populations, to go along with that. And most of those, unfortunately, are spelling increases in the opportunities for those animals to survive along with the ticks and the bugs in the ticks. So that's not a good recipe for decreasing tick-borne illnesses.
So in general, then, are warmer temperatures contributing to that rise in the number of ticks in our area?
Yeah, there's been a few studies in the Midwest as well as in New England looking, for example, at moose populations and the ticks that are affecting them. And so one study last year found an average of about 47,000 ticks on one moose. And I think the record that I've seen is around 200,000 ticks on a moose. And part of the problem there for the moose is, you know, they're sort of sitting ducks. They can't exactly do tick checks on themselves and pick the ticks off of them. So they rely on the winter season to have those ticks die and drop off in the cold. And when that cold season is shorter, they can drop fewer ticks. So they've been finding all these moose carcasses with, as I said, 47,000 average ticks on them, which is that's a lot of weight to carry around.
That's an enormous number.
I don't even
want
one tick on me, let alone 47,000.
Right, no kidding. Aaron, you're the Howard Young Foundation director. Explain your role with this new tick center.
Yeah, the Howard Young Foundation just has been an incredible organization that started in 1984 to help with advancing the health and wellness of the communities we serve. We also have a group that's a fantastic group of women called the Women's Legacy Council. And it was a former board member who actually brought this project to us. We were looking on what's our next challenge. And this was something where he had a friend who had been suffering from some time that lost his battle, and another friend who was currently suffering. And what he felt was there's a real gap in the market. He didn't recommend that we start just a regular treatment center. He wanted something that addressed both diagnosis and treatment in combination with research. And that, to him, was the real differentiator, because we needed to help solve the problem. So that's why we took on this project, and I think we were very excited to go to the absolute best centers in the United States that have devoted their careers to research and treatment, who then referred us to Dr. Andy Kogonek and Open Medicine Institute. So we're proud to partner with Andy to get this center up and running for a huge need for our community. Whether you've been recently infected or have been dealing with it for some time, we wanted a place where there was diagnosis, treatment, follow-up, and research.
All right. Doctor, when somebody contracts Lyme's disease, how is it diagnosed? Is it difficult to diagnose?
Well, officially, Lyme disease is still a clinical diagnosis, which means that the doctors need to look at the symptoms and look at sort of the constellation of what's going on and make the call. Lyme disease testing is, in short, a mess. There are many, many tests out there. There is no true gold standard, and different physicians will argue about which test means what, which is one of the biggest problems. CDC uses what's called a two-tiered test, which is basically one test and then a confirmatory test, which is great at picking out positives, but it's also great at missing a lot of cases that could be positive, because part of what you're measuring is an immune response to that bug. And so it's complicated, and it's something that the average physician, I think, can't do easily necessarily in, you know, the short amount of time they have with patients today. So, you know, a lot of cases do wind up getting missed. A lot of cases get treated in the primary care setting, and that's great. But, you know, there's definitely people who are relying too much on the laboratory tests to make a diagnosis, and that's not enough.
Okay. What's the life cycle of ticks like? I mean, what conditions do they prefer, and how does that work?
Yeah, they love sort of warmth and wetness and woodlands. So the most common place you'll find a tick is sort of in the scrub in the forests, and obviously up here in the north there are tons of lakes and tons of woods, so it's a great combination for ticks. They have lots of different hosts, but obviously the deer are one of the primary hosts, and so they will hop on to an animal, take a nice blood meal, hang out there for a while. Some of them will even, you know, ride that animal through the winter months. The less fortunate will die off in the winter months, but then they go and lay eggs, and the cycle starts over again. And people are essentially a a side infection for them, a side host. they might get a nice blood meal off of us, but they don't tend to stay on us for too long because we're a little bit more meticulous about looking for them. But there's
unlike
a lot
the
of
moose.
Unlike the moose, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. Are there other tick-borne illnesses that you're focusing on at this center? I mean, we talk a lot about Lyme, but are there other illnesses to be concerned
about?
Yeah,
Lyme is certainly the one that gets the most press and probably also has the highest numbers, with CDC estimating over 300,000 cases, new cases a year now. But there certainly are others, Anaplasma, Ehrlichia, Babesia, and numerous viruses now that are emerging. Powassan virus is one that's been pointed at up here in the Midwest. That is also, all of those are carried by the ticks, and there's probably a number of things that we don't know about that may be carried there as well that we're still learning. There's quite a constellation of potential illnesses, and unfortunately they all have a little bit of overlap in terms of symptoms, so that makes the diagnosis that much harder.
Okay. It looks like the current evidence suggests that climate change is an important factor in the geographic and seasonal variation and in tick-borne diseases. But are there other factors, too, that we could maybe land use patterns? I don't know. I mean, what are some other factors?
Yeah, I mean, certainly globally, we're increasingly putting people in contact, in closer contact, perhaps, than we used to with animals. So that's one factor. And the wilderness. But there's also lots of changes in terms of food and environmental factors, in terms of toxins and things like that, that can hamper people's immune systems. And that is definitely a factor in terms of how we as individuals respond to a tick or any infection for that matter, right? Some people have a more robust immune system and others won't, and that may affect whether that particular illness takes hold in that person or not.
I guess I have to wonder, do you foresee your research having an impact on new treatment or prevention options? We were talking about this in the office here, and one of my colleagues here is a hunter who spends a lot of time in the woods, and he's wondering, is there ever going to be such a thing like an ankle bracelet, like a dog collar that repels ticks? Is there anything like that that you think is possible for the future?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's a lot of work going into that. It's not our particular focus at the moment, although certainly prevention is key, and I would carry that message forward to everybody. There are already a lot of groups working on different devices and different techniques for lowering tick populations, as well as just, wearable kind of things like the collar that you mentioned. There's also some work in the vaccine world, and even some kind of crazier ideas about inoculating mice with certain strains of, genetically altered stuff to wipe out the Borrelia, which is the bug that causes Lyme disease in ticks. So there's all kinds of work going on, but I think hopefully some of that is in our near future rather than in the distant future.
Okay.
We're certainly looking at clinical trials and other treatment patterns as well in the clinic.
Okay. I mean, I know you're not open yet, but I understand you're already testing some blood. What have you found so far?
Yeah, so we've done some screening events just in the general community, and with the help of the foundation, last year we screened about 300 individuals, and actually about 240 individuals that were tested for the various tick-borne illnesses. And we found actually about a 25% positivity rate to one of any of those illnesses that we talked about. And some people even had several of them turning up positive. So that was really a shocker to us, that the numbers would be so high in this area, and really, has certainly spurred us on to dive deeper, and was a confirmation, I think, that we're going at a high need and an issue that's going to be here for a while, that we really need to start addressing as a community.
So that was a bit of a surprise to see that those kinds of numbers.
Yeah, you normally would not see that anywhere else in the country, except for maybe Massachusetts and Maine.
Okay. So really, I mean, looking at data from the CDC, there's a pretty significant uptick in the cases of Lyme disease. How do we compare in Wisconsin?
Well, the last surveys from last year, I think Wisconsin was ranked fourth, but I can tell you that data is based on voluntary reporting from physicians to county health offices and from the county to the state and from the state to the CDC. And we've met with a lot of the different county folks here, and they are overwhelmed. They basically can't report enough cases, and so they don't have enough resources to report all of them. So the fourth in the U.S. ranking for the state of Wisconsin is probably a gross underestimate of what's actually going on, which is kind of a frightening thought.
Wow. Okay. Aaron, how can potential patients or people who have questions about the center, how can they learn more about it?
Well, a couple of ways. I think, first of all, we have a huge challenge. We at the foundation have agreed in order to put this in place, we wanted to fundraise $3.5 million, and that's half the cost to getting it to three years of operation. What I'm really proud to say, though, is OMI is on board as well, and they're matching it. So they're putting up one half the cost, too. And we at the foundation have already raised over $1 million, but we still have $2.5 million to go. So if anybody feels strongly that we need to build the first center of this kind in this region that will help over 2,000 patients a year across the multi-state area and potentially even nationally, like Dr. Kogelnick said, we already have a patient wait list, please do go to howardyoungfoundation.org and donate. Also, if patients want to get onto a patient wait list, Dr. Kogelnick has information he can share with a phone number as well so that patients who have questions can contact the center by phone and email.
All right. All right. We have to take a break, but a very quick question. Do you foresee a Lyme disease vaccine in the future?
I think there are efforts to try and bring that back. I think there's a lot of issues to be addressed since the last round didn't go so well with the Lyme disease vaccine, but I think there's promise for that.
All right, thank you. Well, I would like to thank our guests, Dr. Andreas Kogelnick of the Open Medicine Institute and Howard Young Foundation Director Aaron Beertz for joining us today for this important discussion. When we return, Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Rob Menser will be joining us. He'll discuss his recent reporting on the rising lake levels throughout our area and the potential health impacts on local residents. You can join the conversation too. 800-780-9742. I'm Shereen Seward, and this is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. In this segment, we welcome Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Rob Menser. He'll discuss his recent reporting on the rising lake levels throughout our area and the connection to human health. So, Rob, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you. You spent some time reporting on rising water levels in the area. I have to tell you, I traveled recently to the Northwoods and to Lake Superior, and I was really shocked at how high those water levels were. What did you learn in your reporting? I mean, is this a thing that's happening all over Wisconsin?
No, there's no doubt that lake levels in Lake Superior and Lake Michigan are at historic levels. They're extremely high, and there are a lot of impacts from that. So I went to an event in Green Bay this week that was put on by Representative Mike Gallagher, the congressman, and it was sort of an event geared toward local government officials. It was called Fording Floodwaters, and so it was really all about responses to what we know is the increased frequency and severity of flooding in Wisconsin. And you can see it in recent history when this year there was severe flooding in Green Bay in the spring as snow was melting, and there was a bunch of rain in April. Stevens Point has faced this multiple times in the last couple of years and as well in Wood County. There have been other places, you know, the southwestern Wisconsin, like La Crosse, that whole area saw a lot of damage to croplands as a result of flooding. So this was an event that was all about for local government officials, not like what are the best policies to stop climate change from happening? Mm-hmm. But like, what can you as a local government official do to mitigate the effects of flooding? How do you respond, you know, apply for federal disaster aid when something happens? you know, what is available to you as a local official to try to make some difference.
Okay, and we have a clip from that meeting that you took. And who is speaking in this clip?
This is Jeff Last. He's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service of Green Bay. And he spoke directly to the question of how climate change is being felt in Wisconsin.
All right, let's take a listen.
What we've seen with the warmer climate is more extremes. So there are more heavy precipitation events, more April snowstorms, things like that. There's no one particular event that we can say is a result of a warming climate, but in some, there is evidence that it is part of that, yes.
Interesting.
Yeah, I found Last's presentation, one element that I found fascinating, and this gets to the high water levels in Lake Michigan, is Green Bay now experiences flooding without heavy precipitation events, without a serious rainstorm. He said that just this month there was flooding that was caused by a nor'easter, like a northeastern wind coming over the bay, causing water to slosh forward and actually caused flooding in some parts of Green Bay. This month, it wasn't like – this is not like a, you know, many millions of dollars damage sort of event. But there is something like – I don't know. There's something slightly alarming at the to me at least. It was new to me, the idea that you can have flooding without having experienced a heavy rainfall. And of course, he speaks to the fact that that heavy rainfalls are becoming more common and more severe.
Certainly. That's interesting. I'd never heard that before either. We see so much flooding here in central Wisconsin, too. The Rib River, the Little Rib River. I mean, we've had repeated events like that, especially over the last couple of years. And is it true that that's more prevalent? I mean, is it really more prevalent, or is it just my imagination?
Yeah, no, it is absolutely more prevalent. The you named several, and it's very apparent in central Wisconsin. Madison had severe sort of historic and historically damaging flooding in 2018. There was severe weather that did hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damage to infrastructure in northern Wisconsin, like Ashland, in 2016, which is not that long ago.
Oh, sure. I remember roads were washed out for weeks.
Culverts, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep. Saxon Harbor. It was very serious. So one measure of this, just to the are we imagining it point, mm-hmm. is so the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, tracks billion-dollar weather events. And that is to say disasters that cause $1 billion or more in damage. Mm-hmm. And you can chart that, and it is a straight line. It is climbing.
Really?
They are becoming more frequent over the last 10 years, I believe was the chart that was presented at this event. I believe it went back to 2008. But at any rate, the trajectory is not jumpy. It is quite straight. And those are certainly increasing. Wisconsin, in particular, was a site of four of those billion-dollar events in that time period. Now, that also includes, you know, maybe that's like with Minnesota or this year's flooding that also did huge amounts of damage in Iowa and Nebraska, and Wisconsin was part of that. So it's not to say that $1 billion of damage was strictly localized to Wisconsin, but as part of these large events, it's a measure of the increasing severity and the increasing damage from
sure.
from weather events.
I was reading an EPA report that said the changing climate is likely to increase the frequency of floods in Wisconsin. Over the last half century, average annual precipitation in most of the Midwest, including Wisconsin, has increased by 5 to 10%, but rainfall during the four wettest days of the year has increased about 35%. So that's a pretty significant figure reported by the EPA.
It adds up. I mean, yeah, and this has been a – we are in a historically wet period. It is not necessarily the case that there will never be another drought again in Wisconsin, right? I mean, like the last 5 years or so, rainfall levels have been very high. Precipitation has been very high. And, these things don't all move in a straight line. So there's going to be variation from year to year. But the point here is that the expert opinions, the scientific opinion is that we are headed in a direction, and that direction is increased precipitation.
Okay. Let's talk about the impacts of this. I'm reading here the National Climate Assessment that came out in November. It comes out every couple of years. They're saying that this kind of the extreme storms, the flooding, the heat waves will cause crop failures in the Midwest, including rural Wisconsin. And there's actually a part of that report that predicts agricultural yields could drop to 1980 levels by the middle of the century. I think that that's an interesting statistic. What do you think that means for us?
It's troubling, especially given the many other stressors on Wisconsin agriculture right now. It's kind of like, there are enough variables in that come with being a farmer, whether it's international trade or tariffs or whatever, to add an additional stressor. Mm-hmm. That's damaging. That's bad. And I think that it is also a realistic expectation that I know that from my reporting, I've talked to many farmers who see that as the normal, the new normal for them, and what it is what they expect in their future as in that business.
Okay. I also want to mention tribal communities. This is also mentioned in that report. Tribal nations, especially vulnerable because they rely on natural resources for their cultural and economic needs, which could be further threatened. That according to that National Climate Assessment report that came out in November.
I want to talk also about the emotional impact of being in one of these flooded communities. The reality is that many of these communities, some you name, some here in central Wisconsin, because of where they are situated on the river, whether it's the Wisconsin River here or Mississippi River or Fox River, whatever, they see flooding with some regularity, and they may see sort of upstream flooding happening, and they know that it is coming in their direction. So as the effects get worse, as the climate becomes more extreme, it's doing more damage. And just besides the damage caused by one flood, there are real long-term traumas that can result here. So Katie Summers is the state hazard mitigation officer with Wisconsin Emergency Management. I spoke with her at the Fording Floodwaters event in Green Bay, and she talked about the impact that this has on local communities.
All right, let's hear what she had to say.
This is a very traumatic life event for people. They lose everything. They go into extreme debt or declare bankruptcy after these events. And when they hear the rain start again and they're still in that same location that's flooded before, they panic, they shut down, they cry, they reach out for help.
I think that's a powerful statement. My husband and I have friends who live along the Little Rib River here in the Wausau area. And they are subject to flooding almost annually. Some of it has been historic proportions in recent years. FEMA came in and bought up many of the properties along that area. That used to be a very heavily populated area off of Sherman Road, if you're familiar with that area, on the west side of Wausau. And very few houses remain. The holdouts who turned down FEMA, they're ready for it. You know, they've done things like fortified their homes and moved their electrical outlets up significantly and added six or seven sump pumps to their lower levels. And they're still, because they don't want to move, they're just refusing to move. But every time there's another huge flooding event, it is quite traumatic for them.
Yeah, it's a – so the floods can kill people. I mean, people can be washed away in high waters and there are other health risks that we can talk about. But I do think that that's something that it's worth at least pausing to think about the trauma that comes from that being just a feature of your life. And that's thousands – that's tens of thousands of Wisconsinites. You know, just to say, we also know that floodwaters themselves do present a number of extremely dangerous public health risks. So floodwater harbors bacteria and parasites. This is not a Wisconsin example, but in North Carolina, a man died last year after he was out cleaning up hurricane damage in his yard, and he just had a cut on his leg. It got a bacterial infection from this floodwater, and he died from it. That can happen. The CDC warns against gastrointestinal illnesses, skin infections, and other diseases that can come in the wake of floods. And of course, these things also increase the risk of mosquito-borne illnesses because, like, mosquitoes like standing water, and this is a this is another hazard. So there's like the impact to structures and houses. There's the potentially the direct impact of if someone is swept away in floodwaters, which can happen. But there are all these sort of follow-on effects that might not be so apparent, but that really come back to these climate events.
So there is a public health element to be considered with this that is correlated to this.
Totally. And, you know, so there can be whatever. People's septic systems or sewer systems can be ruptured and cause, you know, bad stuff and germs to get into town. There are also, you know, chemical spills can happen as a result of this. The water is extremely powerful, and when it is taking over a town, as we've seen the images happens, it can spread all kinds of dangerous parasites and chemicals and microorganisms that, like, we don't want in our towns.
Sure, and I would imagine those Blasto, you know, those kinds of things that mold spores can create health problems for animals and people in flood-prone areas, even after those waters recede.
Absolutely, and it's why you can't just dry out stuff. A lot of times, the damage that comes from flooding, like that stuff is not salvageable in many cases because it's not just a matter of like drying out your couch. It's that it could be infected with who knows what.
So. Right. So there's a lot of infrastructure issues as well. You know, with buildings, with homes, with businesses that are along those waterways.
Mm-hmm.
So I think your reporting is very interesting. And I mean, are there any solutions?
Well, so the solutions are complicated. So we know that, right, there are high profile attempts to address the root causes behind climate change. And like we all know that those are highly they're within the political system, let's say, mm-hmm. and therefore controversial. There was a really interesting so on the local level, sure, there's mitigation. You can move people out of floodplains, as you describe. That honestly is part of the solution, is making sure that there are not structures in vulnerable places. There are building codes that can help raise those electrical outlets. Sure. Here's one that I found really interesting that was discussed in the event is wetlands restoration. So wetlands, what are wetlands, right? They are they trap and allow water to stay. And so in some places where wetlands have been taken away due to development or whatever, it just makes it inevitable that that water that has poured into the river is going to proceed downstream where it's going to cause flooding. But if you have wetlands upstream in some of these places, then that may not be the case. They may be able to intercept, to catch and hold some amount of that water, thereby lessening the effects of the flood downstream. That is not, I will tell you this, that is not exactly a high on the policy agenda in Wisconsin mm-hmm. right now, but there are people who say that it should be, and there are a couple of pilot projects looking at wetlands restoration as a flood mitigation step, and I find that very interesting, and I think that that to me is worth looking at more.
All right. Well, we do have to take a break. A huge thanks to you, Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Rob Mentzer. Appreciate you sharing your research with us as we continue our exploration into the indirect threats of rising temperatures throughout central and northern Wisconsin. When we return, Wisconsin DNR research scientist Gina Lalibardi will join us to share information on the effects of larger and longer algal blooms in our area waterways. You can join the conversation too. 800-780-9742 is the number to call. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. In our final segment today, we welcome Wisconsin DNR research scientist Gina Lalibardi to share information on the effects of larger and longer algal blooms in our area waterways. We'd like to hear from you, too. The number to call is 800-780-9742. Gina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
I have a hard time saying algal blooms. Algal bloom. I feel like I should be saying algal blooms. So.
Well, it's...
One of those
because it's Greek, yeah. Truly Greek.
Well, I'm glad you know more than I do. So, for starters, I think it would be helpful if you could explain what they are. What are they? Where do we find them here in central and northern Wisconsin?
Well, when we talk about algal blooms, we're mainly concerned about blooms of blue-green algae, which are also known as cyanobacteria. And cyanobacteria or blue-green algae are actually in every water body in Wisconsin. They're in every river, stream, every lake. There are even some that live on land. They'll be in bird baths, and they can grow in mud puddles. But in lakes in particular, when we refer to blooms, that's basically when blue-green algae have the right conditions, mainly a lot of nutrients that they can use for growth to grow to nuisance levels, so levels that you can see them in the water. And most often in lakes, algal blooms of planktonic blue-green algae, so floating blue-green algae species, are going to appear as murky green water or sometimes surface scums. It can be a lot of different colors.
Okay.
And blooms can also occur as sort of wind-blown accumulations too, because planktonic blue-green algae can float. They're moved around by wind, so you can get large accumulations if wind's been blowing in one direction in a lake. You can get them accumulated in downwind areas, too. And especially in northern Wisconsin, in really clear lakes, there are blue-green algae that live on lake bottoms. And since they are photosynthetic, so they go through photosynthesis just like plants and produce oxygen, oxygen can bubble up on these bottom-growing blue-green algae mats, and it can lift them to the surface. And we get a lot of reports of these, especially from clear lakes in northern Wisconsin in the summer.
So are they all harmful or not?
No, not all blue-green algae can make toxins, which is why we're concerned about them. Toxins can cause illnesses in humans and animals who ingest them or inhale them, or in some instances they get skin irritation from skin exposure. But not all blue-green algae can make toxins, and even those that can don't make them all the time. But in general, any time you see a large accumulation of blue-green algae that you can notice them with the naked eye, they're appearing as green water or scums, that's when you do need to be cautious.
Okay. So, like, I'm a kayaker, and when I'm kayaking in a river, especially later in the season, I see these all the time. So when I see them, when I see this big mass of blue-green algae on top of the water, that's something I should be cautious about, at least.
Yeah, be cautious. I mean, definitely be careful if you're kayaking, especially if you're prone to dumping and falling out of the kayak, which I hope you're not.
No, I'm not. But it happens.
It does.
It happens to the best of us.
Where our main concern would be is if you have really high accumulations, small children and pets should definitely be kept out of those conditions just because they have smaller body sizes, so it doesn't take them swallowing very much water to potentially make them ill.
Okay. Well, in our last segment, we talked about the rising waters in our area and the potential for flooding that exists. How does that contribute to the increase in blooms that we're seeing, or doesn't it?
Well, maybe not directly flooding, but definitely the increase in precipitation, and particularly these heavy rain events that are becoming more prevalent in the Midwest, can have an effect in that you get these heavier rainstorms and you can get more more runoff and associated sediments and nutrients coming into water bodies. So you get these nutrients. So phosphorus and nitrogen are needed for plants to grow. They're needed for algae to grow. They're needed for blue-green algae to grow. So if you add more nutrients, you're adding fuel for them to grow to nuisance levels.
Okay, what about warmer temperatures? I mean, in general, are warmer temperatures contributing to these longer blooms in our area?
Yes, they can. Blue-green algae are actually adapted for growing at higher water temperatures than other more desirable algae. So when we've got warm water temperatures and a lot of nutrients, those are conditions that they really like. And especially when we tend to see blooms happening and surface scums accumulating is when we have rain events that bring in nutrients followed by hot weather and then calm weather too. Because planktonic blue-green algae float, if you get a period of calm weather, that allows them to float to the surface of lakes and form scums where they really become noticeable.
Okay. I guess I'm curious, what's the life cycle of the blue-green algae like? What conditions does it prefer?
Well, they like it warm. They like a lot of nutrients, and the calm conditions really allow them to accumulate. That at least is true of planktonic blue-green algae. For the ones that live on the bottom, they like clear water because they need the sunlight to reach them on the bottom of lakes.
Okay. I do want to remind our listeners that you're welcome to call in with questions at 800-780-9742. If you have a question for our guest, please don't hesitate to call. Gina, are more bodies of water affected or unsafe compared to past decades? Is this a trend that we're seeing?
Worldwide, there is some evidence that is occurring. In Wisconsin, it's harder to say. We don't have a lot of long-term records for blooms on lakes. We do know that there are some lakes that have had recurring blooms, at least since, I want to say, the late 1960s. There was some research by a University of Wisconsin student in the late 1960s who focused on lakes that were known to have recurring bloom issues. There have been a few other studies since then that have revisited some of these lakes, and the blooms are recurring. And I think there is a lot more focus on blue-green algal blooms more recently. This week marks the fifth anniversary since the Toledo water crisis, when a blue-green algal bloom was producing toxins, and that toxin was getting into the finished water for the city of Toledo, and the water supply had to be shut down for Toledo. And since that Toledo incident, there has been nationally and that lot more attention being paid to the occurrence of blue-green algal blooms.
Is pollution a factor too?
Nutrient pollution is a factor. So any sort of pollution, nutrient pollution, whether it's from point sources or non-point sources, can contribute nutrients to water bodies that can fuel blue-green algal blooms.
Okay. All right. I guess I'm curious how this affects lake health as a whole. What does it mean for a lake when you're seeing these increased and larger, longer blooms?
Well, it's ecologically, it can have a number of effects. If you have a large algal bloom that is starting to decompose, the bacteria that are decomposing that bloom can use up a lot of oxygen. So you can have reduced oxygen in the water, which obviously can affect all the other organisms that need that oxygen. Toxins possibly could have an effect on the organisms in the lake. And blue-green algae really aren't a great food source for aquatic organisms. Other true algae, such as diatoms, are much better food sources for the base of food webs in lakes. So they're really a blue-green algae are a poor food source, and in that way, they can impact food webs in lakes as well.
Okay. What about our ability to safely consume fish? Does it have any impact on that whatsoever?
That's a really good question. There's a lot of unknown things right now. At least for the toxin microcystin, that's probably the most frequently occurring blue-green algal toxin that occurs in Wisconsin. We know that in fish, toxins tend to accumulate in the organs. So eating just the fillet is a better option. And there has been some research at The Ohio State University looking at different methods for measuring toxin in fish tissue. And what the Ohio State University researchers have found that there is a small accumulation sometimes in fish muscle tissue, but at least for the state of Ohio, it was at levels that were well below their fish consumption recommendations for the state.
Okay. All right. So ingestion is certainly one way that you'd be exposed to the bloom, the toxin. How else are we exposed to it?
Well, in addition to possibly getting some toxin from fish that seems to be at manageable levels, mm-hmm. and accidentally ingesting water while swimming, people can be exposed if they are, for example, water skiing or tubing through blue-green algal blooms. If you're inhaling water droplets, you're inhaling the blue-green algal cells, and if those cells are producing toxins, the toxins as well. So that's an exposure route. And another one that some people have reactions to blue-green algae that get on their skin, and they can develop rashes. That tends to happen most often if blue-green algae get under clothing, for example, a bathing suit, and they're rubbed against the skin.
Mm-hmm. I've actually had that happen while kayaking, getting that rash from mm-hmm. and it's unnerving. I don't know how dangerous it is, but it was unnerving. I mean, are some people more sensitive to these effects than others?
Well, at least for the skin. The skin effects, the rashes and irritation. There's anecdotal evidence that people that tend to have a lot of allergies tend to be more susceptible to these the skin effects of it.
Mm-hmm.
With accidentally ingesting water or inhaling water, that would depend on how much you're exposed to and also your body size. So adults might not have as bad a reaction as a small child who is really getting more of an effect per pound because of their smaller body size.
Okay. Well, I have one final question for you, and I don't know if there's an answer to this, but is there a way to reverse this trend? Is there something that can be done?
Well, a lot of the things that the DNR is doing with our partners to reduce nutrient inputs to waterways are... That's the main way we can keep algae blooms from becoming more prevalent in Wisconsin. If you don't have the nutrients, you don't have the fuel that will help them to grow to high levels. So nutrient reduction is really important. So not just on a statewide level, but everyone can play a role because everything moves downhill, and mm-hmm. if you have nutrient inputs uphill, it's going to end up in a lake. So doing things that you can... to increase infiltration, especially lake homeowners should make sure that they're maintaining their septic systems properly if they're on a septic system. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of things that everyone can do to reduce nutrient inputs to our waters.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the information. That's unfortunately all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. I'd like to thank our guests, Wisconsin DNR research scientist Gina Laliberti, Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Rob Menser, Dr. Andreas Kogelnick, and Howard Young Foundation Director Aaron Biertzer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Our on-air producer today is Joy Retchkramer. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route51. Next week, tune in for another great discussion. Until then, we're heading out of town.